My name is Mike Smith. The topic is humanitarian intervention. It is, should the United States intervene to end suffering in foreign countries? That has been sort of the theme all week. I did Bosnia Monday, I did Somalia Wednesday. Tomorrow I want to look at the United Nations and look at the different tools the United Nations has that it can use or that it has used. My sense is that the United Nations has a variety of tools and it has a legitimacy that sometimes I think the United States doesn't have, but it has very limited power. So there needs to be a careful application. Whatever the United Nations does needs to be applied pretty carefully. I wanted to begin by saying what my assumptions and preconceptions are. Most U.S. interventions in the past, most U.S. interventions in the past have been intended to serve U.S. interests, to serve our national interests. My sense is that we do not very often focus on what's the impact on the people in the country. My impression is that very often when we have conducted an intervention, that the effect on the people in the country hasn't been very good. That we may or may not have served our own interests, but I'm not sure we very often served the foreign country's interests. The second sense I would have about humanitarian interventions is if we do intervene, our task is to help the people in the country solve their problems. And sometimes we look at it as our job is to go solve their problems for them. I don't think that makes any sense because they have to live in the country. It is their country. They have to create forms of government. They have to live with their neighbors in a workable way. So what we may be able to do is help them get to that point. But whenever we start thinking of it as we have to solve their problems for them, that's just a mistake. That's not going to work. I don't think. I ended up several of these. So the other thing I would mention, and we mentioned this a moment ago, this summer is listen to the sacred, and we have some trouble doing that when we talk about these kinds of topics, and so. That's part of the challenge today, is to try to bring that in. We didn't do that very much on Monday or Wednesday when we talked about Bosnia and Somalia, and I'd like to try to do that some more today. What I want to do in terms of organization, and we may change this because we don't have very many people yet, what I'd like to do first is to define humanitarian intervention and talk a little bit about that idea, what that would be. I want to talk about the ways the U.S. has to influence what happens in other countries, the different kinds of ways we try to have an impact in other countries. I want to then talk about the particular cases that are the cases that are foremost in my mind, and that's Bosnia, Somalia, and Haiti. And I pick those cases because I think they're different. They raise different problems. And to me, then, we might say that the U.S. has a responsibility to deal with one problem, but not another. And so I'm picking them because they illustrate different kinds of problems. And one may be more amenable or more appropriate for us to do something about than another one would be. But if you come to the conclusion we have no business intervening in any situation, that's fine by me. In any event, I start with a definition of humanitarian intervention, and this is a fairly crude definition, but I hope it says the basic things. I'm talking about military intervention. I'm talking about using military force in these situations, and the point of using military force in a foreign country is because there is suffering going on in that country, and we're trying to do something about it. We're trying to reduce or end the suffering in that country using force. You might say that there's something paradoxical in that very idea. You know, using force to end suffering.
It's really difficult. So
in this definition, when you say military intervention, are you specifically meaning not just the presence of troops, for example? I mean, maybe this could never happen, but assuming troops never used their weapons or anything, they were just there, and they had weapons with people who were new. like as a deterrent?
I would consider that a very low-level military intervention.
Okay, yeah, because I agree that it's military intervention, but I didn't know if that was the type you're talking about, or if you meant that it specifically force had to be used.
Yeah, no, what I'm trying to distinguish this from is that there are cases where we don't like what's going on in the country, we apply economic sanctions, where we may offer aid or something, we may offer some kind of assistance to affect what happens in the country. There are other steps we take to affect what happens in other countries that are steps that are short of military force.
Right.
And so I wanted to talk about the case where we use military force.
Okay.
Even though it may be at a low level.
Okay.
Would you consider what we've done in Somalia to be a low-level military intervention?
I would say it was. I would say it got raised a little bit when those Pakistanis got fired on, and then they fired into the...
Well, the danger always is when you have military that you have at your disposal military means. It's very visible.
Yeah. And a parallel danger is that you become a target. You're there, you're trying to do something, and somebody doesn't like it. You may become a target for them. And then that raises the real question, do you fire back or not? Do you shoot back? And the Pakistanis seem to have been poorly trained. They fired into a crowd on an occasion when it wasn't justified. It wasn't just firing back when they were under fire. It was more than that.
They lost their head.
It was worse than that. So you could say, well, gee whiz, if we had really well-trained troops, then it would be better than what happened there. But still, once violence starts occurring, if you're raising the level of the situation, and it's not under your control. When people start firing on you, you hope that doesn't happen. But if it does happen, you're stuck. You need to have thought out in advance how to respond.
Right. Because you're going to have to respond in some way.
You figure that, probably.
I mean, you don't have to, but I guess a non-response is a choice, too. You have to choose something.
Choose to be sacrificed.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's what it would be, because if you're being fired upon and you don't respond, you're going to get killed.
Yeah, that's a real possibility. Well, yeah, let me give a couple examples to illustrate this a little bit. 1982, we sent troops into Lebanon because we were invited. The Lebanese government said, we're having trouble stabilizing things. We've been fighting each other for a long time. We're sick of fighting each other. We need help. Can you send troops in to help keep the peace in Lebanon? And that was fine. And that was fine for a year or more. But then at some point, some of the groups in Lebanon said, we don't like the situation anymore. You know, we're unhappy with the political arrangement and we'd like to change it, and we are willing to use force to try to change the political arrangement. And so at that point...
Who said that, the Lebanese?
Yeah, a faction. There were a lot of different factions in Lebanon, and one of the factions there then bombed the U.S. Marine headquarters at the airport.
Right.
And so what was our response? Our response primarily, I think we did some offshore bombardment, but the other response was, we're taking the troops out. We had them there as long as they were welcome, then we pulled them out, which is the other option. The other example I would give you is some of the forces in Bosnia right now. These are not U.S. forces, these are what Canadian and French and some other forces. That when they run into trouble with the Serbians say, we don't want this caravan of relief supplies to go through. They say, okay, it won't go through. We'll talk to you, we'll try to negotiate and have you let us take it through. But if you say no, that's all right. If the Serbians say they want to search a truck, they say, okay, search the truck. And what happened a few months ago was they found weapons. They found that somebody was trying, in a UN truck, trying to smuggle weapons into the Muslims. And the Serbians got very upset about that. But in this case, the peacekeepers have tended not to become a target, just because they do whatever. If the Serbs say do this, it's okay, we'll do it. Now, the worst thing that happened under this situation, to my mind, is that I guess he was the vice president, one of the leaders of the Bosnian government was in a convoy that was a UN convoy, and the Serbs stopped the convoy. And they searched the convoy and seized him and killed him. And you would think in some sense that the soldiers in the convoy have a responsibility to defend
who they have.
This guy.
Yeah.
But their decision, I mean, that's a tough call. But if they don't let the Serbs have the guy, then they're going to get in a fight with him.
Right.
And so they turned him over and he was killed. Which...
Who were the soldiers?
In Bosnia, there was a government that was chosen by the people of Bosnia. This was, I believe, the vice president, the number two person in Bosnia, in their government. Now there are a lot of factions fighting against that government, but the Serbs in Bosnia, the Bosnian Serbs, seized this particular convoy that had this fellow in it. The peacekeepers who were directing the convoy allowed them to search, allowed them to take this man away, and then they killed him.
But who were the peacekeepers?
The UN.
They were UN.
This man was in a UN vehicle.
They were soldiers, but they were UN.
Yeah, they weren't like prosecutors.
No.
Okay.
No. But what I'm saying is, on the one hand, you can sympathize with them because they say, we don't want to make anybody angry. We're not going to stand up to anybody. And since we're here, but we're here as observers more than anything else. We're not here to get in anybody's way. But in that case, the effect was that this guy gets killed. A leader of a government gets killed.
So he was not protected as would have been seen to be the...
I mean, that if they weren't clear what the rules were that they were playing under, that became clear after that. That this is not a safe haven. You're in a UN convoy. That's not safe ground. The Serbs will look anywhere and go anywhere. And so nothing, you look out for yourself. No one, the UN is not going to look out for you.
So we let that go by and nothing was done.
But that is, we're talking sort of about levels of military intervention, and that's a very low level role. We are here, but we're not going to fight anybody if we can possibly avoid it. Now, if someone starts shooting at us, I believe the terms of engagement are they can fire back if fired off. But if someone just stops them, they have a roadblock, and they stop them and say, we want to search your convoy, the response is, search our convoy. Go ahead. See what you can find. And then please let us through, and if you won't, we'll talk to you until we can convince you to let us through. But what I'm trying to illustrate is levels, and obviously you can have a much higher level of military intervention. And what we did in Kuwait, in the Persian Gulf War, is a much higher level of military intervention. I'm not sure that's humanitarian in that case, but
that
it is.
That wouldn't fit your definition. The word humanitarian and military
are troublesome.
Provocative terms.
Well, that's precisely why we're talking about it. Because historically, this has not happened very often. Historically, if you look at the times that countries send troops into other countries, they almost always do it for their own purposes. They don't send troops into other countries because they say, oh, there are poor, suffering people over there.
Right.
They say, well, we want a piece of territory, or we want something else. We want to change who your government is. Those are the reasons they send troops in.
So it's a fascinating shift to the way we think on how to use military power.
And I would say it's partly the end of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Cold War is over. We were in this struggle with the Soviet Union. We intervened in, I don't know, half a dozen or more places, almost always in opposition to communism. We said there's a danger of communism and we want to respond to that. But that was serving our interests primarily. It may have helped the people of the country, although more often than not, I think it didn't.
Yeah.
But it served our interests as we saw them. And the communists did the same thing. And the Soviet Union did the same kind of thing. But now, that's not a concern. But people are saying, you look around the world, there are lots of places where there's trouble. In some sense, the world seems to be in worse shape. The end of communism seems to, and the decline of the Soviet Union seems to have just opened up, a Pandora's box of problems all around the world.
A lot of unfinished business that happened prior to the Second World War.
Well, yeah, in a sense, or it goes back to the First World War.
Yeah.
There are a lot of conflicts that got stifled, and I had a history professor 20 years ago who said that there were ways that having the Soviet Union was good because it stifled conflict in Eastern Europe. And the Soviet Union is gone, and now that conflict is breaking out.
You mean like primarily ethnic
conflict.
So Czechoslovakia has broken in two. We now have the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Yugoslavia is broken into five parts.
Yeah, what are those five parts? Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Okay, yeah, that's one.
That's one.
Bosnia and Herzegovina is one. Slovenia is one. I guess I can come up with five. Croatia is one.
Right.
Serbia is one. And Macedonia is one.
Okay.
Now there is a sixth republic, Montenegro, but that's joined with Serbia right now. Serbia and Montenegro right now are one country.
And all those places have different, the people of there are of different ethnic groups.
There are different, yeah, there are different dominant ethnic groups. Bosnia is the one where the Muslims are the largest group, but they're not quite half. In all the others, then there is an ethnic group that's the majority. And so Serbs in Serbia, Croatians in Croatia, and so forth.
Did the Serb-Croatian conflict first break out due to communism coming into the country?
No, it was going on long before the communist
state. Was it hundreds of years? Hasn't it been going on for, and just the fact that it's flaring up now is like, well, it's been flaring up forever.
Yeah.
And it's going to forever. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah,
but when you look at the history of that country.
But they live peaceably.
That's
next door to one another.
How come suddenly they're enemies?
Well, they were held together through a Tito. This is where the breakup of the Soviet Union and that whole communist system broke down. Just to expose their
weakness.
Ages of conflict.
Yeah,
just finished this book that Kristen Twain suggested. Which is called Balkan Ghosts, which is just awesome. About
that, explaining,
that is really worth getting.
Oh,
okay.
It explains they're still talking the late 1300s, and we're going to retake that territory.
Yeah,
Serbian people are.
The Turks defeated the Serbs hundreds of years ago.
600 years ago.
And the Serbs remember.
These are Muslims.
And so they are, the Serbs are Eastern Orthodox, the Turks are Muslims, so those Muslims took our sacred land and defeated us hundreds of years ago, and we've been struggling against one oppressor and another ever since, and sometimes the oppressor, the Croatians and the Slovenians have friends in Germany, so sometimes the oppressor is Germany, and including World War II, World War I. Sometimes the oppressor is some Muslim of some sort or another, but the Serbs are battling all these enemies out there that are trying to do them in. And they feel like they've been mistreated now. I think they misread history a little bit. They slant history to arrive at this perspective, but they believe it. Many of them, I'm not saying they all believe it, but many of them very devoutly believe that they've been mistreated and ought to get it back somehow.
The land. And
get the land back, get some sacred territory back, drive out Muslims.
Spiritual heritage back.
Yeah. And
Roman Catholics, priests, for example, are perceived as the Archbishop of Croatia as okaying the massacring of Greek Orthodox people intentionally, consciously.
So it's that is a tough situation to deal with. In any event, let's come back.
How do you stop?
I'm talking about here, and I think you can begin to see why I have the different cases. Why I want to look at Somalia as well as Bosnia. Because Somalia is a case where a country just broke down.
Mm-hmm.
Country stopped working.
What about Sudan? I mean, that's why I would like to learn a little bit more about that, because isn't that going to be another Somalia?
It's not exactly the same. Somalia, the people are pretty much all Somali. They're 99% Sunni Muslim. In Sudan, you have racial differences, Arab, black. You have religious differences with Islam in the north, the Christian and native religion in the south. So it is. So you have some of the problems that you have in Bosnia, in the Sudan. And they're problems that we tend to think make situations worse.
Yeah.
You know, when you have the religious differences and the ethnic differences. Those aren't present in Somalia. Somalia is just a government that doesn't work. I mean, has just utterly broken down. And in some ways, my sense is, I feel more compassion and more of a sense, gee whiz, we have a responsibility to go in there.
Into Somalia.
That in Bosnia, it's just so difficult to unravel. I mean, there is lots of suffering, the ethnic cleansing, the apparently systematic rape that's occurred. You know, it is horrible. But I guess my sense is the prospects of actually improving the situation aren't very great, and so I hesitate.
By military force.
The military force, you go in against the Serbs, and they're going to think you're another outside oppressor. You're like the Germans or the Turks.
So you mean because they're to them, they're seeing it as they if they don't achieve their goal, which would be to take back, is this right, to take back their land and their whatever, then they're going to fight anyone who prevents them from doing that. So it's, in that way, it just seems unresolvable to me.
With military.
Yeah. Or at all. Because then if they win, I mean, I'm using a win-lose situation on purpose. I mean, then they'll be losers. I mean, and the losers will want to fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems what's like the situation you've got there, very much.
Well, it's kind of hard to know who the bad guys are.
Yeah.
Because there really probably aren't, I mean...
Well, I think you can rest assured most of the people there do not think that they are the bad guy. They think someone else is the bad guy.
Right.
I think a lot of those people are fighting because they're told they have to.
Well, some, yeah.
People who used to live next to each other's neighbors, Serbs and Croatians, have to take their turn at going to the front lines and fight. And it's not because they want to.
And there's pressure, too, on the Serbs because there have been Serbs that sided on the behalf of the Bosnian government against the Serbian armies, and they've been called traitors. They, you know, we will hang you if we can get our hands on you. You are evil people because you are, you know, and there are splits in the communities. Not all the Serbs in Bosnia want to support this fighting, and I suspect that's true probably on all the sides. But
I think we see this partly through the eyes of the media,
and
that's so skewed. And I don't think we see the individual people. And I think it's, I was saying before, I think it's powers against principalities, it's not people. Not that evil that's occurring, that's the absence of God.
And ironically or unfortunately, at least some of the people are invoking religion in behalf of what they're doing.
Always, that's always been the case.
That's been the case, and I was religious.
You know, which is particularly alarming. Anyway, I want you to consider for a moment one other thing. When we have this category, humanitarian intervention, somebody did a study a few years ago. I think it was a political scientist named Rudy Rummel, and it was if you locate it, it is one of the most poorly written things I've ever run across. But the basic point is very sound. It's like he was just sort of reading and thinking and stuff, and he said, "Oh my goodness." And then he wrote this thing up and zipped it off, and it got published someplace. But what he did was he looked at the number of people killed by governments, you know, within their own country. So he looked at the Soviet Union and Stalin and the Gulag and the number of people killed there, and he looked at Hitler and the Jews and so forth. But he looked at governments, you know, committing genocide, governments mistreating their own people, and then he compared it with statistics. And as I said, this was a fairly crude article, so he just had statistics on deaths as a result of World War I and World War II, but he took all the wars in the last 100 years or so and then compared them with all the reports we have on mass killings and genocide and such in countries. And there were far, far, far more people killed by governments, you know, internally, governments killing their own people than the number of people killed by wars, which I think raises a little, comes back to this question of humanitarian intervention a little bit, that we've created an international system that says that countries do not meddle in each other's affairs. And this is what, if you read the Charter of the United Nations, it says that you do not meddle, one country cannot interfere in the internal affairs of another country. So if South Africa does terrible things to the people of South Africa, that's their business, it's not our business. If Russia does terrible things, if the United States does terrible things, and you can understand why governments would agree to those kinds of rules. Government of the U.S. says, well, you know, sometimes what we do, other countries might not understand, but we have an agreement. It's our business, it's not their business. So we let Germany or Britain or whomever it is, you know, and there are nice countries out there and governments that are decent in the way they treat their people, but we also, we let in the South Africas and we let in the Cambodias, you know, we let in these countries that don't, the Burmas, the Myanmars, we let in the Sri Lankas and so forth. The rules are, we aren't going to countries have complained about how South Africa treats its people, but still the general rule is, it's none of your business. We just do what we want. Now, as I say, the issue that I think gets raised here is when we recognize how terrible governments are to their people some of the time, then it raises this question. Do we have a, you know, are there times when we should intervene? And that's the question, of, to me, to my mind, of humanitarian intervention. Okay?
Well, if that was the rule, then how come, you know, how come Nicaragua and how come...
How come what about Nicaragua?
You know, just, yeah, sort of that sending weapons and intervening in governments because they were communistic. I mean, what's that about?
Well, we for our economy. If you are a strong country, you don't always have to follow the rules. And so we haven't always followed the rules. And we have felt that this is very important.
For our own interest.
We had something to gain by it.
The government in power said, it, yeah, sure.
It's like there are two things here. I mean, they're, because one is a situation like that where I think it's like for our own good. I mean, like Nicaragua, you know, we go in there because it's our economic benefit if we have a government in power that aligns with us and then we can do what we want economically and tell them the crops to grow and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe that's for us. And then there's a situation being presented where, in its purest form, we would ideally be going into a country for the genuine purpose of protecting the people of that country from their own government.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know my history well enough at all to know of situations where that's actually happened and been successful without, you know...
I have trouble thinking of any occasions.
Really?
How about Kuwait? Did we go in there?
No.
That was our oil.
That was totally for oil. It's just
I like to think it was for the other reason, but I don't know. I'm not sure.
Somalia comes about as close as possibly can be in my mind.
Somalia is a good.
There's
good
nothing
example.
You want out of Somalia.
Right. That's okay. That's
except
a good
we
example.
Do have control of that.
Yeah.
The
it
water.
Has
the water.
Strategic. It has some strategic value.
But in yesterday's session, it was brought out about Somalia that. By the one woman who is a foreign service person, that we do have oil surveyors there, two major oil companies.
Yeah, apparently there is oil in Somalia. So
there is kind of a little.
There might be a reason.
Yeah.
Another instance which I would think comes fairly close is the Lebanon case I gave you in the early 1980s. I think when we sent forces in there that we wanted to help keep the peace and establish a stable government in Lebanon, which is I think a good kind of purpose. Well, the other thing is that if there's stability in Lebanon and it was a Christian government, that serves Israeli interests. So it's also good for our friend Israel. But and I have to suggest, and the Kuwait example is another example, there are often multiple motives. We're not doing it for just one reason. We objected to Saddam Hussein going into Kuwait because we don't think countries should commit acts of aggression. He also did it because of the oil. And you can't say it was just one or just the other.
Right.
And some of those are more morally acceptable reasons than others are. But they all get mixed up in taking the action. And that could also be true in Somalia with the oil being a minor interest or maybe greater than that. And in Lebanon, a mix of that.
We haven't been trained yet, so we shouldn't go. They told us
I went
last
year.
They said they were going to have a drill.
Today, at 1:50 though, but not. They weren't going to have. I don't think they were going to do. Well, maybe they were going to do the.
A private nurse was
the Cyrus.
They were just
the
firefighters. They were just the.
Yeah, I don't think they.
Well, I would say if you're trained staff, you should go, and if you're not.
Don't
go, because the other thing they tell us, and I'm not trained, is you'll just get in the way.
Yeah.
If you go when you don't know what you're doing, you'll just get in the way.
Right.
so.
Yeah, we have our team. They did say they were going to have a drill today, though.
Do you want to go see what
this is? I just want to hear where it is, because if it's, isn't it, if there's an alarm like this, and it wasn't the drill thing that we're talking about, I was surprised last night. Why didn't we all get out of here? Out of
you're supposed to hear a bell.
Are you supposed to exit here?
You're supposed to hear a bell where you are.
The red light there?
That means get out.
Oh, that light,
oh,
that
if
light
you hear a bell, then it's for that building.
That's what they told us for our building.
Computer
system. Oh, but if it's red light, it's just to get people who need to go to buy them on. Oh, okay, got it.
If you hear the bell in that building.
Well, I think they burst in the door too very quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
This building.
That's true.
Just don't trip over the chairs as you go.
So can we save the whole world?
Well, let's not jump to our question yet. What I wanted to do next is talk about the different kinds of ways that the United States tries to influence what happens in other countries. So these are, in a sense, tools of foreign policy. And I was sort of hoping Chris would be here, because I imagine her analysis, she's in the Foreign Service, that her analysis would be a little more sophisticated than what I'm about to present. But in any event, it seems like there are the following kinds of tools, and I'm starting with sort of the least intrusive and working my way up to military, which would be pretty intrusive. But the first would be diplomacy, which is negotiating. It is offering to be a go-between if countries are having a conflict or parties in the country are having a conflict to help them settle it, to be an arbitrator. There are various kinds of diplomatic services that we could provide. What I'm not sure if this is more intrusive, but I wanted to list this, what we call public diplomacy, which you could see as either public relations or you can see as propaganda, depending on how you want to look at it. But efforts where we try to convey some sort of interpretation of the world. The first diplomacy, I'm thinking more of face-to-face negotiation, sort of private discussions, government to government. Public diplomacy is more reaching public opinion, trying to reach the public and change their minds and hoping by doing that to change what governments do. The next level would be economic. And at one level, what we do is we offer economic incentives. So we say, you know, we'll say something like, we will give you foreign aid. We would like you to do something or other, and if you will do that, we will give you foreign aid. So for instance, we look at a society and we say, this society is really has a lot of economic inequality. There are a few rich people and a lot of poor people. There ought to be land reforms. We will give you economic aid if you perform land reforms, which we think may eliminate some of the roots or some of the causes of conflict in that society. So it can be aid. It can be trade benefits. We say, okay, what we will do, if you will do what we want, we will let you sell goods. You know, we'll let you get around the tariff barriers. We'll give you special trade treatment if you want to sell stuff to the United States. Or we'll do other sorts of things for you. So it might be, as I say, trade, where what we're doing is we are encouraging them to do something, and then we'll reward them if they do what we want them to do. Or we offer aid but attach conditions. We will give you aid, but you have to reduce human rights abuses. And this is a common thing the United States has been doing almost 20 years, is conditioning aid on human rights. We won't give you aid if you develop nuclear weapons. We won't give you aid if you pollute the environment or other sorts of things. Now we can get a little tougher and have sanctions. We don't like what you're doing, so we're going to penalize you for what you're doing or what you have done. And so we restrict trade. We make it hard for a country to borrow money. We do other kinds of things that penalize the country for their past performance and say, we're going to keep doing this until you change. And then going beyond that, we get to the military kinds of options. Now, generally in international law and generally the way countries think about these things, they figure these kinds of activities are pretty much legitimate. They're okay. You know, we don't like what your country's doing. We can offer aid to change it. we can impose sanctions to change it. It's not considered, I mean, maybe it ought to be, but it's not considered particularly evil or wrong for us to impose sanctions on a country whose conduct we don't like. Does this all make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, well then the other thing I want to do a little bit here is talk about cases. And the cases of Bosnia, and we've said quite a bit about that. Somalia. Is there more we need to say about Somalia? Do you understand what's happened in Somalia? Or do you have questions about that?
I have questions. I don't know if I understand it fully. Basically, I know that. Well, what was the government before? Was it pretty much a warlords? Isn't that? Yeah, I don't know. Is that what it is now? I know there's not a government, but warlords are fighting each other.
Yeah. What it had been. It had been colonies. Somalia had been British and Italian colonies, and they were put together in 1960 to be one country that would govern itself. It was democratic for about 9 years, and then at the end of the 9 years, a dictator took over, Siad Barre, and he governed Somalia from 1969 until 1991. So it was 22 years of dictatorship. In the early years, he was pro-Soviet. His neighbor Ethiopia, which he despised, was pro-US, and so he was pro-Soviet. And the Soviet Union loved it because it's an important location near the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. So they built a major naval base in Somalia. Then Ethiopia, the guerrillas in charge of the military forces in charge in Ethiopia decided to line up with the Soviet Union. And when they did that, Somalia decided to switch sides and be pro-U.S. So we inherited this naval base.
So they switched in 74 then when Ethiopia deposed Haile Selassie and when...
It was shortly, it was two or three years after that. It was a little after that.
So they were pro-Soviet, Somalia was pro-Soviet from 60 to 76 or so, and then...
Something like that.
U.S., pro-U.S. until 91.
Well, I think the U.S. started getting a little sick of it. After the fall of the Soviet Union, I think the U.S. started saying, this is an embarrassment to be supporting this guy. He is a brutal dictator. He is wiping out the traditional leadership. He's trying to wipe out the forces that are potentially would resist him or potentially could govern the country in his absence. So I think we got a little embarrassed about our relationship, but for a long time during the Cold War, we armed him just as the Soviets armed Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons there's so many arms in the country, isn't it? That was one of the impacts that we had. They had about a two-year civil war, and in that civil war from 1989 to 1991, the army did a lot of destruction. And so part of the reason there's famine and starvation in Somalia is because of that civil war and the way the civil war interrupted the normal growing cycle and people feeding themselves and or transporting food for the people. Most of the people were farmers in Somalia, but they couldn't, you know, they either couldn't grow their crops or if they grew them, the army came in and took them, or the rebels came in and took them. So it was a very disorderly time and destructive time, and what's come out of it, you have mass migrations with a lot of people fleeing the countryside where they grew up, fleeing to the cities or fleeing to neighboring countries. And then you have the rise of the warlords. There are a lot of guns there, a lot of young men who are happy serving one gangster, in a sense, a gangster or another. So it's a mess. You know, and
Are we doing any good there?
It seemed like, well, yeah, I guess I would say that probably sending the troops in did do some good. It did open up some of the transportation so you could get the relief supplies to people who needed it. So some people got fed who weren't being fed. And it did seem to curb the violence, at least for a while. Now we have violence directed at the UN forces. And you have to make a call whether that's worse than what was going on before. One of the things I neglected to mention yesterday, it occurred to me after we were done yesterday, was that part of the arrangement some of the relief agencies had worked out with the various gangs and thugs was, we'll give you a portion, you know, we're bringing in food or we're bringing other supplies, we'll give you a percentage of it and you let us through. You protect us from other gangs and thugs, you let us through and then we'll give you a portion. And it's sort of like paying a tax. And so what they had done was they said, you know, as long as the tax isn't too high, as long as we still get 60% of our food through or 60% of our medical supplies through, we don't mind paying this tax to these guys. But when it gets too high, when the tax is 100%, because we have to pay off gangs at the, you know, that unload the stuff at the docks, and then we have to pay off people in town, and we get out in the countryside and we have to pay off
nothing
people.
Nothing gets through.
Yeah, nothing gets through. When they start gouging too much, or when they don't protect them, so okay, you pay the protector, but then you travel a mile or two and some gang
it's
comes up and...
protector.
Yeah, they're not protecting you, they're just taking their share. And that's part of what was happening.
And in the meantime, people are suffering and starving. It's just,
yeah.
It just doesn't seem like any solution, if there is any solution to it.
Well, you figure what would be good is to arrive at some kind of stability. And presumably they will do that sooner or later. The question is whether by intervening we help them arrive at it sooner or not, or the United Nations helps them arrive at it sooner or not. But that's my sense, and I think that corresponds pretty much with what we said yesterday.
Yeah, well, that one lady, that's what she said, we could get back to the type of government they had before, the different chiefs or whoever ruled there, certain tribes, and then work with a more central government that they were responsible to, keep law and order in the different areas, and then work that way so that at least people are fed and going back on some kind of economic level where you could barter and trade again.
Yeah.
And at least keep people fed, as was brought out yesterday. At least people were fed in that system. Maybe it wasn't what we look at as being economic.
Most traditional societies had some way of distributing food and taking care of everybody. And if the traditional leaders, if Somalia is a network of clans, there are different clans throughout Somalia, if the traditional leaders of the clans could reassert their authority, and that's difficult when you have so many guns and so many young people running around with the guns, but if you could, you know, resurrect the authority of the traditional leaders, then that's probably a starting point for some kind of reconciliation or solution to the problem. What I guess I find disturbing about Somalia is the sense you're going to have to be there a long time. I don't think you're going to have a solution overnight. It's going to take a long stay to solve it. And the American response is, well, we will go in for the first 5 months and get the process started and then turn it over to the United Nations, and the United Nations can then be in for the long run and deal with the headaches that are the long run headaches. Okay, the third case I want to bring up is Haiti. And Haiti is much closer to the United States. Bosnia, Yugoslavia is in Europe, in sort of Eastern Europe. Somalia is on the eastern coast of Africa, but Haiti is in the Caribbean. It's not too far away. It's part of a nation. Do you know much about Haiti?
All I know is that it's primarily Christian. Ousted, and that's all I know.
Okay, yeah, the United States actually occupied Haiti for a long time early in this century because of government instability. I think we were in there about 17 years or so. We were there for a long time trying to help them get started. And this is one of the reasons I have, some skepticism about our capacity to install effective governments in some of these places. But we were there for some time. What happened, they governed themselves, and I don't know how well, for 20 years or so after we left. We left, I believe, under Franklin Roosevelt, under the good neighbor policy. They governed themselves for 20 years or so. They chose a president, Papa Doc Duvalier, back in the 1950s. And he ruled for 6 or 7 years, and then he decided to declare himself president for life. So he went from being the president to the permanent president. And so he was then president, and as you can imagine, the dictator in Haiti the rest of his life. And when Papa Doc died, his son replaced him. And so we then had Baby Doc Duvalier rather than Papa Doc Duvalier, and he was dictator for a while. And finally, there was so much of a public opposition to Baby Doc that he fled to France or Switzerland or someplace. And he, of course, had stashed millions away in Swiss bank accounts and was going to live out the rest of his life in great comfort. And this was partly, I don't recall Reagan or Bush, but Ray, one or the other, was helped. This was about the same time we were having the problem with the Marcos in the Philippines. And the United States sort of said, look, we don't look kindly on these dictatorships anymore. And we'd like to see a change of government and a change to a democratic kind of government. And so Baby Doc left. And the military took over for a while and said, well, we'll have elections. And they had elections, and they elected this guy, Aristide. And you remember, Jean-Baptiste Aristide, I think is his name. Anyway, they elected Aristide. The social situation in Haiti is that you have a strong military, well, fairly strong military. You have a gang of thugs that had served the Duvaliers, went around the Tonton Macoutes, went around and beat up people when the Duvaliers didn't like them. So they had their own gangsters and thugs. You had a small group of people who were very wealthy. Most of the people in Haiti are very poor. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So it's in pretty bad shape. You have a lot of suffering in Haiti. But in any event, Aristide gets elected. The military doesn't like some of the things he's saying. He's saying we're going to have to redistribute the wealth. We're going to have to cut back on the money being spent on the military. So they replaced him. They said, you can't be president anymore. And Aristide was sent out of the country. There was some thought that they were about to kill him, but the U.S. stepped in and said, we won't sit still for that. And so he was exiled instead of being killed. And so Aristide is now in the United States. Do you know anything about the kind of response we have made to that situation? Well, what you know?
We've embargoed.
Okay, and what we did, and I like what we did, we talked to the Organization of American States. We talked to the other countries in the Western Hemisphere, and we all agreed that we didn't like this. We didn't like what had happened in Haiti, so we agreed collectively to impose an embargo. It wasn't just the U.S., it was the U.S. working with a lot of other American countries saying, we don't approve of this, and imposing an embargo. Now, the principal effect of the embargo was to make the life of the poorest people in Haiti more miserable, which is the kind of thing that happens when you say we aren't going to buy things from you and we aren't going to sell things to you. The rich people can get out of the country, they can get stuff smuggled into them. The poorest people very often have no recourse, so the greatest suffering was probably among the poorest people. Now, you know, you come back to my list here, what we were doing was fairly strong, economic sanctions against Haiti. But it was short of any kind of military intervention. What do the Haitians do? A bunch of them try to leave. A bunch of them try to get on boats and come to the United States. And what's the American response to that?
Go home.
We don't want you. Stay away from here. You know, stay there in your own country. You're not welcome here. We've got enough immigrants. We've got all these Mexicans and people in Southeast Asia and all this. And we don't want any more immigrants. So they have a bad government. We tighten the screws in an effort to change what's happening there, leads to immigration, and our response to the immigration is, you stay home. You know, we say, you're not fleeing for political reasons, you are fleeing for economic reasons, and that's not an acceptable reason. You can't, if you're a political refugee, you can come to the U.S., you can't come to the U.S. if you're an economic refugee. Go back.
So, like, it's okay if you're afraid of dying from a bullet, we'll accept it, but if you're afraid of dying from starvation, we won't accept it.
Right, right. And those are our standards, and we are enforcing them. And we set up a naval blockade to intercept boats and send the people back. So we've been pretty tough. Now, the most recent development, as I understand it, is we've tightened the sanctions. We've imposed more sanctions. And according to Monday's New York Times, I haven't seen Tuesday's yet, or Wednesday's, but Monday's New York Times says the leader of the military in Haiti, a man named Cedras, is meeting, well, he's not exactly meeting with Aristide, but he has gone to New York and they're doing negotiations where they are on Governor's Island together, or they're in the same building or something. They're not talking face to face, but we're acting as a go-between to try to negotiate an arrangement where Aristide can go back to Haiti.
And rule.
And be president again. Now, the problem is the military says if Aristide comes back, we want no punishment against the people who did the coup and ousted Aristide.
So they'll be there to pull another coup if they need to.
Yeah. Well, they don't want to suffer for what they did. But in some ways, they have some cards here. They are in power.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And to some extent, you don't settle these situations unless you are prepared to forgive the other side.
How long was he in Aristide, the president, before he got...
I don't remember the exact date.
I mean, but just approximately, did you say months or years?
About 1990, and I'm not sure, but about 1990 is when he was elected. And,
oh, yeah, that's right, that's what you said.
And I'm not sure how long he ruled. He was a Jesuit priest. He apparently had pretty inflammatory language, pretty leftist kind of language, but the analysis was he wasn't like that. But the concern, and I think the concern in the military, was the people around him, some of the people who were his supporters, were pretty extremist. So he said, because he was a Jesuit priest and cared about social justice and the poor, he said some pretty strong things. Probably, you know, he's a practical guy, he makes compromises, you know, you can't just take away all the property of the wealthy, so probably he wouldn't have done anything as drastic as it sounded like, but they decided not to take a chance. So the wealthy in the military got together and got rid of him. Now, my hope would be that they can work things out. If they can work things out and Aristide goes back and it settles, that would be wonderful. The question for humanitarian intervention, given that there is and has been a lot of suffering in Haiti, is if it doesn't work out, do we go one step beyond sanctions, to some kind of humanitarian intervention? Okay, at this point, I really want to turn it back over to you. We only have a minute or two remaining. Do you, you know, we started out saying that one of the problems when we have these discussions, it's hard to listen to the sacred. It's hard to get that message.
If we mean by listening to the sacred, that one of the main themes, realities of sacred is that there's a favoritism about the poor
mm-hmm.
and the dispossessed. And that's listen to the sacred in that context. Then, if that's the case, then what we would do would be on behalf of that process. It could really radically shift what we might do. And would one take violent means to enforce the support of the dispossessed?
Mm-hmm.
That's an extremely important issue. I just laid it out.
Yeah. Well, that's how I see it.
That's listening to the.
You know. It seems to me that there's a strong message about social justice, and there's a strong message about, as you say, the poor and the dispossessed. At the same time, there's a strong message about force and killing,
and about taking somebody else's property away from them and redistributing. I mean, that could be called.
Well, I'm not sure there's quite as strong a message about that.
All right. No,
but. But the message about property, it's, you know, when...
What is property?
I don't know. I mean, I really wanted to avoid trying to interpret.
Yeah.
I'm not a theologian, but it does seem as if Jesus encourages voluntary generosity, voluntary charity.
Stewardship.
We're going beyond voluntary charity.
I should have brought that one in. That's another
issue.
But you're right. I mean, I asked the question. Would that be a means for listening to the sacred? So therefore, using military means would be a sacred intervention, which gets you to the whole issue of just war.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it's like gets really complicated because of that, if I use that right, but
it would be wonderful in one sense in history, if I understand of church history, that one or two times we would do that on behalf of the poor. It's usually on behalf of the rich they're doing.
Yeah.
All our history is checkered with on behalf of the rich.
Or we do it in behalf of the government.
On behalf of the government, the power of the establishment.
And there's...
Even Martin Luther's got a bad record on that.
Yes.